That's right. We're right here with Connie Reagan Blake. How you doing this afternoon? I'm Ann Eller, and I tell you what, I have a treasure sitting right here across from me, and she is a storyteller par excellence. She has gotten the Circle of Excellence, the Oracle, and Lifetime Achievement Awards. I think I read she's been on TV, CNN, and other stations, too. I have Connie Reagan Blake sitting across from me. How you doing today, Connie?
I'm doing great, Ann, and delighted to be here.
Well, it's good to have you here. Get you down off the mountain, right?
That's right.
Coming from Asheville down here. And, of course, Prudence is sitting here with us today. She has decided to be quiet today. Now, if you want to say something, Prudence, we'll put the mic over there. But she, of course, is the executive director of our library system here. She has been going around with Connie Reagan Blake. They have been telling stories, over in 96 today?
That's right. We did. I did three different performances for high schoolers there.
Wow. And then tomorrow you're going to, and then you end up Wednesday at Ware Shoals, and you'll be doing a live performance for anybody to come to, correct? At 10 o'clock in the morning at the Ware Shoals Community Library. That'll be at 10 o'clock. So if we can tempt you here today, you need to remember that at 10 o'clock on Wednesday, you can go hear more of Connie Reagan Blake.
And I would say that would be more for adults or teenagers, or, you know, because it is at the high school there, it won't really be geared for younger children.
That's
so
true. Yeah.
So just a little heads up on that.
Yeah, don't bring the little kids to think they're going to story time, right?
That's right.
That's right. Okay, well, we had you on a couple of years ago, and you've been very busy since the last time we talked to you.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, actually, and it's very exciting. I actually don't know if I mentioned to you that all of my materials are going to the Library of Congress.
Oh, my God, what an honor.
It is. I am delighted about it, and my first shipment of boxes went out about a month ago, 10 banker's boxes, and I'll probably have at least 15 more that will be
Now, are these audio tapes?
No, this is actually, it began a number of years ago when I was going through some materials that I had and came upon some cassette recordings I had made way back when I was traveling around telling stories, but I was going to more folk music festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would have my little tape recorder and tape some of the masters in that world. And I came upon this box of them, and I thought, you know, there's probably a lot of musicians that would love to be hearing some of these from back in the 1970s and 80s.
Right.
I knew someone at the Library of Congress Folk Life Center, and so I called him up and said, I have these cassettes. He was delighted, and the first thing he said was, oh, we'll put them in the Connie Reagan Blake collection. And I said, the what? And it turns out for 20 years of my storytelling life and career, I had a partner, my first cousin, Barbara Freeman. We might have talked about her before. Well, she had had some boxes of stuff that she had sent to the International Storytelling Center. They ended up sending it on to the Library of Congress. And Todd, my friend there, said, as a matter of fact, you are the most collected storyteller we have, and we would like to have everything you have.
Oh, my God, Connie, what an honor.
And this was a number of years ago. It was 2009. And I was just thrilled. But I, looking back on it now, I'm a great believer in general on timing and how things unfold. I definitely, over those years, would be back in touch with him and say, you still want everything, and I think I can get it together. And then it just didn't happen. But I'm trusting and know that this is actually the perfect time for it. And they want everything that I have written on. And I am somebody that has kept a lot of materials.
Did you keep a journal?
I did. I've kept calendars where I was, I have a calendar for every year, and I would put in those calendars kind of very short diary things about where I was going and where I was traveling mm-hmm. and performing. Some of it with that partner, and then in the 21 years since then, right. you know, of traveling. I also sporadically kept different journals, not on a very consistent basis. But I kept correspondence back when we used to do correspondence through the mail. And, you know, that the United States Postal Service.
Delivered.
I also made copies of a lot of things that I sent out. So I have original pieces where they were handwritten. I've never been much of a typist. Mm-hmm. Handwritten with scratch through and how I might do this and say it differently. And then I saved then their response to that. And I have all of these. So the boxes are mostly papers. I have all the contracts, you know, storytelling contracts that date back from the 70s and 80s and 90s. I also have, I remember coming across so many of the, as I've gone through the boxes, sorting these things, it's been a very exciting journey for me and reminded me of a lot of things. There was one, at one point, there was a company up in New York that wanted to video storytellers and sell these on, right. on DVDs, on video. Probably it was on VHS at the time. And I have all the correspondence and these letters that I wrote to each of the people they had asked. These were storytellers all over the United States. I think there were 20 or 25 of us. Detailing, don't you think we ought to be thinking about this together? You know, what kinds of things do, what kind of parameters do we want to put in writing in this contract? Rather than each storyteller
sure.
doing a separate contract.
Good. Right.
And I have all of those notes for
oh
that.
Oh, my goodness.
And then you mentioned on my Facebook page,
yes.
I have the letter that came from one the person that started the very first National Storytelling Festival. So I have a whole range of items, like I say, 10 boxes that have gone and many more boxes to come.
How does that make you feel to look back over your life as you're going through these boxes and everything, Connie?
Gosh, you know, I feel very connected to it. And there's certainly pride, but it's, I keep coming up with the word gift, that I feel like I've been given this enormous gift to be in the forefront of this revival of storytelling as a performance art. Now, storytelling has always been with us.
Sure, exactly.
And it's one of those things that is the same about all humans. But the idea of putting it on stage, the idea of being behind a microphone, of, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 people or more, or 20 people, being able to listen as a group, all of that has been a more recent thing. So to be able to be at the forefront of that and to kind of see that evolution, and then as I look back on all these papers, be able to see really how I influenced that. But the gift idea, it's been a gift to me mm-hmm. to be able to travel, and the people that I've met, I feel the people that are interested in storytelling are some of the best humans on the planet. And I've gotten to meet a lot of them. And then I think also story itself is a gift. It's a gift that we're always giving to others, and it's one that anyone can give. So there's such
well,
a...
Well, we're all always telling stories.
That's right.
You know, we don't always realize we're telling stories, not like a storyteller, but we are all telling stories.
That's right. It's a part of who we are, of
and
us
it's part
humans.
Of being human.
I think so, too.
Yeah, that's what
and
I...
And it's the way that we are in the world is to listen to stories and tell stories.
Sometimes we call it gossip.
They're different types, different levels of
stories. Yeah, exactly.
But I was telling one story today over at 96 at the high school, and I mentioned to the students that I had found a version of this story in a collection of 12th century Irish tales. So to think back that many hundreds of years ago, people were having a similar experience that we were having right then mm-hmm. of a teller telling a story and these people listening. So,
you know, one of my favorite movies, and not because it's so perfect and everything, is Thunderdome, where Mel Gibson gets upon a group of children who are telling the stories, and they called it the tell, so that they could keep their past alive, that they passed this down, and they were living in one, you know, secluded from everybody else.
I've never seen that. I need to watch that.
It is. It's kind of a cult movie, but this part always impresses me, and I always remember that part because they have the tell, and they tell the tell to the next, to the smallest children, and then they're supposed to be able to tell it to remember the way life was before everything fell apart. Literally. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. It's the way we keep our history going.
Exactly. And I think we do. And I think it's very interesting that storytelling is having the revival. When we look at social media and the disconnect that a lot of people have with other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't sit down and have coffee and a conversation so much. It's all on Facebook. And if you want to know what's going on, you get on your Facebook page and you check out what friend X or Y or Z is doing, or see if they're responding to you. And it can be very isolating.
That's right. At the same time, though, the moth is incredibly popular right now. You know, that's people telling personal experience stories. But they have moth events in New York and Chicago. They have one in Asheville monthly. Other places, you know, it's practically every night that you can go to one. And those things sell out online within 5 to 10 minutes. They have 300 or 400 people coming to listen to stories. So I think we're
hungry for it. So what is it, like a live? Is it like a
live
Facebook? Yeah, live Facebook type thing. Is that how?
Well,
that
no, it's not. It's actually. I was just thinking that even though all of the social media and computers and smartphones take us away from people, I think there's still a hunger to hear stories. So there's still that. You know, there are certain places, story slams and things. It looks a little different than it did even 20 or 30 years ago. But people are still telling stories. I think that we will always do that. I think we're drawn to do it. And so I never really fear that it's going to absolutely die. But I do think we have to pay attention.
Sure.
We have to pay attention to continue connecting, just like you're saying.
Exactly. So they call them moths.
M-O-T-H. Yeah, it's like the moth coming to the fire.
Yeah. Coming to the light, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, because I was wondering how we were making this connection. You know, we've got the butterflies that fly off and the moths that's drawn to the light, right?
That's right.
That's cool. So, are you still doing as much traveling as you did do?
Maybe not quite as much, but you know, a couple of years ago, I kind of said that of maybe I was, you know, it was starting to wind down a little bit. And then the year following that, I think I did more traveling in that year than I had in 2 decades, you know. So it's still definitely there. But I love doing workshops, teaching people how to tell
stories.
And you
do that up in Asheville, right?
I do.
Yeah.
And I do it in other communities as well. Sometimes a community will bring me in and I'll do a day-long or a weekend workshop. But I've been doing that more and more in Asheville, and every summer I do a week-long workshop, and people come from all over. You know, I've often had international people. I've had 2 different people come from South Africa, one from Dubai over in the Middle East, a couple from England. So they're finding me through the internet,
right,
so
sorry.
I appreciate that part of it. But people come together for this full week, and this last summer was my 11th annual one. And I love that, to be able to really dive in and watch other people dive into their stories. And lifelong friendships are formed. You know, there's such a closeness when we are willing to be vulnerable enough to tell our own stories. Then there's this, we let loose of a lot of masks.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this closeness that builds as well. And so I'm loving that. I also do a 3-day workshop called Taking Your Story to the Stage. And that's for people that have either been working with me through one-on-one storytelling coaching, or they've been to my workshops. They've done some storytelling. And then the focus of this particular workshop is getting your story ready for the stage. It's building those performance skills and skills in using a microphone and connecting with the audience and things like that. So I'm loving that as well.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Well, you know, before you leave today, we do have to get you to tell a story, but we'll save that till the end. We'll save that till the end because she tells great stories and can really mesmerize you, whether you're sitting here looking at her or hearing it on the radio. It's good, good, good stuff. So you're down here. You've come here to talk about, what are you talking about in your shows with the children, with the high school students, I guess?
Greenwood Reads this year was Wiley Cash's novel, fiction, called A Land More Kind Than Home. And it's a novel that is set in the Appalachians, right outside of Asheville, actually, in Madison County. And so the library is so good at finding things that connect them with those books that the young people are reading. And I will say, too, that I've never seen quite as excellent a program as you have here in Greenwood for that, to really be bringing, especially high school students. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many things that are geared more to the younger in elementary school and getting them to read and having those books and authors come in. But to really target the teenagers and say, here's some exciting books, you know, and every year to give them a different type of a book, a different genre, different types of authors, and then to either bring the author in or to bring storytellers, to bring people that can make connections with those books. I am just so impressed. I think it's a model that could be used throughout the United States, and I hope maybe it will. But I think the idea behind this was to have me tell more Appalachian stories. Now, I do a wide variety of stories, but the focus this week is stories that either have a connection in the mountains or are traditional Appalachian stories.
Are they different? Are they different than other stories?
Some of them are. Some of the mountain stories are. I was telling the students today that, you know, besides the Cherokee that have been in the Appalachians for millennia, the Europeans that started coming here, many of them were the English, Irish, and Scottish. And I feel that they were looking for something that looked like home. And mm-hmm. kind of when they found these mountains, that green and yet mountains and beautiful rocks, and they found home. And so a lot of them stayed and settled there. And along with their trunks and quilts and everything else that they brought with them across the oceans, they also brought their stories. But what you find is the stories have a rougher edge in the mountains. And a lot of the stories are about a character named Jack. I'm not sure if we talked about that last time.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
But Jack is really found in stories across the world. There's something about his character that we humans like. Number one, he doesn't always appear that smart. You know, if anything, sometimes you think, boy, that guy's stupid, or look at what he's doing, or he's foolish, or he's that, or
is that where Jack of all trades comes from, maybe?
Oh, it could be, yes.
Or I just was thinking, Jack of all trades.
Well, who's that Jack in lots of ways, like Jack and the Beanstalk? And,
right.
And that's a perfect example. You know, his mom and they don't have almost any food at all. They're very poor. The only thing they have is the good cow milk he white. And so his mama asked Jack to take the cow, get some food, get something at the market. He ends up coming home with beans. And you think, my gracious, but he ends up with a pot of gold. And that's the character of Jack. He always makes the best of a bad situation. He's able to kind of turn things around, especially if someone that's in charge that maybe is not quite so honorable. Jack is able to kind of turn the tables on him.
And is Jack an American?
Well, he's really everywhere in the world. A lot of people would claim Jack,
okay.
At least that character.
Right, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when the people came from England, Ireland, and Scotland, they brought Jack tales, and then those stories, so they didn't necessarily originate here in the United States or in the Appalachians, but they certainly have that kind of twist on them. They have a mountain flavor to them.
Mm-hmm.
And really, there's some people that say that's true of all stories around the world. And I feel there's certain things we humans want to be sure the next generations know, mm-hmm. or certain things that we want to be able to tell about.
To tell.
And that's right.
Yes.
And so that we end up with very similar genres all over the world. There's one book that says that is a collection of Cinderella stories from almost every culture in the world.
How about that?
And so we know that they weren't necessarily connecting with each other and telling. So I tend to think it's more human nature rising up and saying, we need a story about this, and it growing out of our own consciousness.
Wow. Cool stuff. Yeah, I'm telling you. You know, that's why it's great to sit down and talk, isn't it? To be able to talk about, whether we're talking about stories or we're going to talk about beads for life and living a creative life. We got all kinds of topics we're going to be talking about right here on WCRS. So, Andy, how about let's run a couple of commercials, do the news and a couple more commercials, and we'll be back. Don't you go away.
Gold. Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here at Sharp Facets Gallery this afternoon, and we are talking with Connie Reagan Blake. She is a storyteller who is alive, who is actually going to be in the Library of Congress. Talk about something too cool, and I'm sitting right across from you. This is so great. You know, I just, you can't really, I bet sometimes even you wonder, how's this happen?
Oh, it is. I'll just kind of pinch myself and go, this is real. And and it's, you know, I'm not, I've always saved papers for whatever reason. And I think in some ways it was fortuitous, certainly,
right.
with this. But I always had that sense of keeping that. I don't save a lot of other things, but
right.
the papers and everything connected to storytelling. So I'm thrilled that I've done it, and I can imagine, you know, people in the future maybe going to do research on this storytelling revival, research on particular stories, on how you make a living.
And coming across Connie Reagan Blake.
That's right.
Now, you also had a friend that did her doctorate thesis on you.
That's right, Milbury Birch, and she's also a storyteller. And she decided to go back and get her doctorate. And she's always been very involved with storytelling in different ways. Back in the 1990s, she and her husband's a journalist, and they had gotten a grant to interview storytellers. And so they had interviewed, I think, over 100 of short interviews, and they picked about 25 to do lengthy interviews on video and audio about storytelling. And so I was one of those that she had chosen. And so she wanted with her, when she decided to get her doctorate, she wanted to revisit those videos to see what had happened in the meantime, some of the questions that she had asked me then about storytelling, to see mm-hmm. if I still felt the same way or had things really changed. And to also really delve into the whole storytelling revival. She calls me the mother of the let's see, what is it? Oh, I don't remember the title of it, the title actual title of the dissertation, but it's something like the foremother of the storytelling revival of performance storytelling. And so it's been, that was a thrilling and sometimes hard, because, you know, like any other thing in life within the storytelling movement, there definitely have been times where there were disagreements or different ways of looking at things. And so some of the revisiting of these memories and things that happened were difficult. Others, because of losing some of the storytellers, some of my teachers and mentors, to really dive back into what I had learned from them and such.
Now, I got to ask you, how did you get into storytelling to begin with?
Well, you know, I never had been on stage ever as a child or as a young adult. Mathematics was my first love. So when I went away to college, it had always come easy to me in high school. So when I went away to college, my idea at the time was to get my master's and hopefully my doctorate in math and then help put people into outer space.
Wow.
I loved the idea about NASA and thought I would like to work in that area. And once I got to college, things changed for me, as they often do for many of us. And I ended up actually switching to political science, which some people say is a good background for storytelling.
Right. Yes.
But at the time, I actually thought that I might want to be a lawyer, and I thought about that I might want to go into politics.
Okay.
And when I got my undergraduate degree, though, I really decided I didn't want to go to any more school right away. I was clear on that. And I was one of those fortunate ones where my parents paid for my college education. I worked every summer, and I was able to save that money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought a one-way ticket to Europe and traveled in Europe and lived over there, hitchhiked, and had a backpack for a year and a half.
Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end.
They did, though, I think. I don't think you can travel.
You can't do that anymore.
Or the hitchhiking, even.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was an extraordinary time for me. You could travel so cheaply. But once I ran out of money, you couldn't make money over there as a foreigner.
Right.
And I traveled all throughout Europe, got as far east as Turkey, Istanbul, and down to Greece.
You wouldn't just go out and travel as a single woman around doing that today, I don't think, either.
No, I have met some.
Right.
But not
the same.
Yes. And right. I did start off with a friend that we graduated from college together, and she started off with me, but she ended up meeting someone and falling in love and getting married.
Okay.
But then I met other people to travel with. But,
right.
But when I came back to the States, that's when I went to visit my cousin Barbara Freeman, and she was a children's librarian at the Chattanooga Public Library in Tennessee. And she's the one that told me it was a federally funded program that was to take the library out to daycare centers. Daycare centers were brand new. The whole idea of Head Start. This was in 1971. They had just gotten word that the grant had been approved. And so Barbara said, I think you can do this, Connie. They were going to hire a storyteller. And I said, great, what is a storyteller? She set me down, told me some stories, and I said, yeah, I think I might be able to do that. And something about it was appealing, including making some money and it having kind of a professional feel to it, working at a public library, as far as on my resume.
Right.
Up to then, I'd only done waitressing with my college degree. And so I went in and applied for the job and got it and loved it. And really, right away knew I was going to try to do storytelling the rest of my life. There was something, I was working with the really young children, but as I tell people in workshops, that as the storyteller, you have the best seat in the house. There is magic that is coming back to you from your listeners all the time. And I ended up, the director of the library wanted to spread the word about this program. I didn't know it at the time, but it was so that the city would pick it up.
Right.
After the federal funding part of it ended. And so she had me going out to adult groups, you know, Kiwanis clubs and university women association and those kinds of things right away. So I got used to telling to adults as well. So really, Anne, my whole life, my only for real job has been telling stories.
That's pretty
awesome. And this year, it is 45 years, 1971 October.
Wow.
Is when I started.
So this is an anniversary month for
That's
you.
That's exactly right.
That is true. That is so cool. And it's so good that you're here in Greenwood sharing these stories. But I understand that you're also talking about a creative life.
how we live a creative life.
Yes, I was talking to the students today about this. You know, so many people think that they're not creative. I have heard over and over again, oh, well, you know, I'm not creative. You know, my sister got those genes, or, you know, my such and such, my cousins were always good at art. But we get this idea, and it's a false idea, that we have to produce something that some people call art to be creative. And whether that's spoken word or it's written, you know, as a novelist or a memoirist, or it's something physical that we can hold on to, a piece of pottery or a painting. But I believe we're all creative, because to live in this world, to breathe, is a creative act. But I think so often we're told as children that we're not. Mm-hmm. And we're told, oh, no, wait, don't color that way. Color this way, inside these lines. That way is wrong. This way is right. Mm-hmm. And I think we start putting layers on top of our own creativity to the point where we don't recognize it very often.
We stifle it.
That's right. And we think ideas are crazy. We go right to this mental way of looking at life. And so if a creative idea rises up, often our first thing is very practical. Well, that won't work, or we can't do that. So we hush ourselves up often. Mm-hmm. Not only society doing that, but we're putting our own damper on it. And what I have found, that the more we can listen, I think that's one of the foundations of being creative and of being a storyteller. Mm-hmm. The more we can tune in to what I call deep listening, then we start taking some of those layers off. And then our creativity is willing to raise that head a bit and say, oh, what about this? And even if that seems...
Just like a seed coming through the ground.
That's right. And so we're not... Before, often we're stomping on it before it even has a chance to break loose of that seed. But if we can nurture it just a little bit, acknowledge, well, yeah, you know, I think I am creative. Acknowledge that, and especially when that first shoot starts coming up, if we don't say, oh, that'll never grow into anything important.
Nope.
That's right.
Yep.
If we can somehow still nourish it, even if it's an outlandish idea that maybe we don't have $85,000 to make that happen.
When would we ever have ended up on the moon?
That's right. If we didn't have that creative spark and the trust. Because often that first idea might be a little outlandish, but if we listen, it leads to another idea.
Exactly.
And another and another. And then that's how I think we can flourish. And what I was telling the students today is that one of my ideas of living a creative life is to be able to do what you love. So you, Anne, as a radio host and interviewer, you are excellent at it.
Thank you, Anne.
To do that is living a creative life.
Yes.
And Prudence here, being a librarian, bringing and connecting people with books and connecting them also with authors and story and spoken word in lots of different ways. That is living a creative life, when you love something. So I always encourage all of us to seek that out, see what it is we can do.
Yeah, it's a shame. We were talking about before we went on the air about people who are in jobs where they just feel, I'm just getting through to the next day.
That's right.
And to not have the opportunity to be creative within that job, or not see the creativity that could be in that job.
That's right. Sometimes it just takes maybe looking at it in a different way. So if you're a mechanic or an engineer, whatever that might be, a teacher, all of those aspects, you can look for the creative aspects of it and then let those shine.
Exactly. And I think, and you're right. And so, or even if you're doing a job you're not in love with, you can find after that job, to instead of let that job keep you down, find that creative thing to do that makes you creative, makes you feel good about yourself and your family and your friends. Yeah.
It gives you a chance to shine.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we don't allow ourselves to shine.
That's right.
And I think, and I really think, I'm going to probably go out on a limb here, I think women are worse at that than men.
You know, I think they might feel the responsibilities of family more. As a generalization,
I mean,
maybe
this
that's
is a wide
changing.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I'm hoping that it's changing. People are certainly looking at more and more that they don't have to fit into a particular mold, and they can see through the internet and through other social media, they can see other options too, which can really be terrific for all of us, I think, to realize that they could be an explorer and go to the outback in Australia, or they could go collect stories in places in East Africa, or they could, you know, make something creative, a piece of pottery, put it on Instagram or put it on Etsy and make their living that way. So sure. I think we are seeing,
more,
including women, I think are seeing more and more ways to couple aspects of their lives.
Sure. I think that I think the younger ones are seeing that more. I think there's a kind of a lot that are kind of stuck, shall we say, in that maybe 45 to 60, 65 age group that were very dedicated and very in one place. Mm-hmm. And I love it when people get to bust out and do what they want. Absolutely. Well, so I guess you're enjoying your creative life.
I am. It's still one of the challenges I have, though, is balancing the business part of it. You know, I've always been good at that as well, and it's something I actually enjoy doing. There are a lot of creative people that just dread having to organize things, but I think there's a lot of creativity in that as well. But I have a tough time sometimes balancing it all, and that's what I'm working on now, is letting some things go and realizing I don't need to pursue every single possibility, or I don't have to answer every single email, or I don't have to handle everything, that I can have more open space. So that's what I'm aiming for right now.
Are you scheduling more open time?
I'm definitely bringing that in, and some time literally just to sit. I love flowers, and I have beautiful gardens around my house, and I in the mountains of North Carolina there, Asheville. The weather is usually oftentimes so beautiful that I just love just sitting, too. Because I think that's another way that we nourish our creativity. That we
nourish
have
our souls. Yes.
Exactly.
We can forget about all these things until the point that you actually feel empty.
Mm-hmm.
And you need that time.
That's right. So I'm working on it.
You're working on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Good for you, Connie. I'm going to look forward to that someday, too. But anyways, we also did want to talk a little bit about your beading that the beading that we talked about the last time, how that is progressing over in Africa. Tell us a little bit more about what's happening, futuristic, what's been happening in that.
And that's in Uganda, East Africa. It sits right on the equator, right at Lake Victoria. And it was actually some friends of mine that had gone over to Uganda. It's a couple. Torkin is the woman's name, a little unusual name, and her husband, Charles, Dr. Charles. And he had been invited to come over there to work with doctors that were working with patients that had AIDS. And my friend, Dr. Charles, that had always been a focus of his own practice. And so he went, and my friend Torkin, his wife, went with him with this wonderful attitude of how can I be of service. And she and two other friends ended up creating this nonprofit called Bead for Life. And I'll say that they have a great website, beadforlife.org, and you can hear some of the voices of the women and learn a lot about it. And you can also see some of the beautiful jewelry that they make. It's jewelry made out of paper, these long strips of paper cut in triangles that the women learn how to roll up into a tiny bead, put a drop of glue on it. Once they have a whole basket of those beads, they string them up, dip them in shellac, and hang them to dry. They do that two or three times. Then they make this jewelry. It's fair trade and fair trade prices for us Americans. And the nonprofit has been incredibly successful. And they invited me to come over a number of years ago in 2007 to listen to the stories of some of the women that were doing these beads, that were making the jewelry. And At that time, the majority of them were from northern Uganda. A lot of them were the Acholi people, and that's LRA, the Liberation Army Movement, that were doing horrendous things in northern Uganda. These women and their families had experienced such atrocities, and I used to say that unimaginable, but I realized it's more that we don't want to imagine. It's too hard to imagine the things that these people were going through, their lives. And so they were internally displaced, and a lot of them came down to Kampala in southern Uganda. And so they were people that were living in such abject poverty. I think it's hard for us Americans. I know that we have a lot of people that are poor and that struggle for food, but that can be hidden here in the United States. And there, it is so out there. Everywhere you turn, you're seeing people who have maybe a mud hut, if they're lucky to live in, and often go days and days without eating anything.
And the children.
Children, you know, and even the idea of the children going to school, that's a dream that seems unattainable. And so that's what Bead for Life went in and started working a lot of with patients that had AIDS as well. So on top of all of that, had a major kind of debilitating disease. But with the right medication and with food to be able to take that medication,
right,
and a clock to know when,
right,
people can live really full lives. And so a lot of those women then were learning how to make the jewelry and were making income for the first time in their lives. So it's been an extraordinary program, and it was really life-changing for me in many ways. But they're continuing and to grow in lots of different ways, and they are now very involved in something called street business schools. And that's working mostly with women who maybe they have bottled water that they're selling, that they found some way to get maybe a couple of dollars so they could buy some water and sell it for just a few pennies more, and each day be able to make a few more pennies until it's quarters and until it's dollars, but still really struggling to make a living, struggling to have enough food each day. And but they're working now with women that already have some business. Maybe they have a chicken and they're selling the eggs. Business in a different way than we look at it here
but
in the United
such,
States.
But in a very small way that's changing their lives.
That's exactly right.
The true example of entrepreneurship that we had in our country. And today, with everything's got to be bigger, bigger, and they're doing and changing their country one egg at a time.
That's right. And it's making a huge difference. And what Bead for Life does
big
is...
Big eggs? No, sorry.
Not necessarily. Depends on the chickens and what they're fed on.
Okay.
Bead for Life. Bead for Life is helping them with entrepreneurial skills, teaching them accounting skills. All of the women open up bank accounts. Because one of the real challenges is that if the women go home with any money, then not only their immediate family, but neighbors and extended family feel that because of an African culture in general, they feel that they
should share.
So now the women can decide how much of that they want to put into a savings account and how much they want to take home and share.
Share.
And so a lot of them now are able to buy houses, their own houses. They are building their businesses because now they have cash to be able to do that. So it's been extraordinary, and other nonprofits are looking towards Bead for Life to see their model. One of the things that they do so well is right back to what we were talking about creativity. Bead for Life listens. So instead of going in and saying, here's how it works in the United States, here's how you should do it, here's how it happens in the Western world, so you should do it this way. Instead of that, they go in and they listen. They're continually doing surveys and asking the women, what's working? What else would you like? What could you see? If you can dream, if your creativity is wide open, what do you see for yourself? Then they listen, and then they try to see how they can incorporate those dreams into what they're doing. And it's working.
That's pretty awesome. And, you know, and to be able to have been there and heard some of their stories, I know we talked about them before, and there have been some amazing stories. You talked about some of the women the last time you were here, and you are listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. So that's been an amazing experience. The fact that you're in the Library of Congress is an amazing experience. The fact that you're here sitting across from me is an amazing experience for me. And the fact that you're going to be here in Greenwood for two more days is amazing for a lot of people to know about. Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock, this is really more adult focus. You are going to be telling a Mountain Tales with Connie Reagan Blake at the Ware Shoals Community Library. That's at 10 o'clock. Everybody is invited to come see that. Now, what I want to do, Gracie, thank you. I want to take a one-minute commercial here, Andy, and we're going to come back, and Connie's going to tell us a story. So don't you go away. We'll be right back.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here with Connie Reagan Blake, and she has agreed to stay over and tell a story. And if you like what you're hearing here and you're enthralled and you want to know more, you can go to your website. Yes?
That's right.
That's right. Your website is?
Storywindow.com.
Okay, so go there, and she even, you can buy recordings from her online, you can listen to things online, so you have a real treasure, and this is a real opportunity for you to go and meet Connie Reagan Blake. She will be at the Ware Shoals Community Library Wednesday morning, 10 o'clock, and again, she said this is really for adults, it's not for small children. But now, drum roll, please. Da-da-da-da-da. Connie has agreed to tell us a story. What are you going to tell us, Connie?
Well, Anne, this is something that's really pretty new for me, but because of what we've been talking about creativity and people living lives and doing things that they really love, I was reminded about this. A number of months ago, I was reading a magazine and came upon an article by Elizabeth Gilbert. Now, you might be familiar with her, the author. She wrote Eat, Love, Pray, and or is it Eat, Pray, Love? Eat, Pray, Love. Thank you. She's written a lot of other books as well. But I was quite taken with this article. She was talking about an experience that she had up in New York City. She said it was cold and rainy outside. She was on a bus, a cross-town bus, at rush hour. And horns were blaring, traffic was building up, and everyone on that bus, you know, people wanting to get home. She said it just felt like people were irritated with each other, irritated with the traffic, and irritated with life. She said there were two guys that were standing in the aisle, and one of them kind of brushed up against the other, and the first one looked like he was going to maybe punch the guy out. And she said, then somebody, a pregnant woman, got on the bus, and no one got up to offer her a seat. She said there was this kind of almost unbridled rage, a sense of anger. And then all of a sudden, they were approaching 7th Avenue, and the bus driver picked up his little microphone, little intercom thing, and he said, now, folks, I know that you're probably all ready to be home. You're probably not feeling so good now because you're tired. And he said, I can't do anything about this traffic. I can't do anything about the weather. But here's something I can do. He said, next stop, I'm going to hold my hand out. And when you get off, I want you to drop your troubles into my hand. He said, there's no reason for you to take them home with you. Your family doesn't need them. Anybody you're passing on the street, they don't need them. So you just drop them right here in my hand. My route takes me by the Hudson River, and I'll just throw them in the river when I get there. Sound good? Well, Elizabeth said, it was like everything on that bus transformed in that moment. You know, before these people had been, you know, avoiding eye contact, everybody was kind of in their own little world. All of a sudden, they were smiling at each other and raising their eyebrows like, is this guy serious? Oh, he was serious. The very next stop, just like he said, he held out his hand, and each person that got off, they mimed right above his hand, dropping their troubles into his hand. And Elizabeth said everybody did it. And some people were laughing and kind of smiling. Other people were tearing up as they did it. And she said it really changed everything on that bus that day. And as she reflected on it, she said one of the amazing things is that, you know, bus drivers, in some ways, they are our invisible workforce. They're people that can be overlooked. But this man on that day, he wasn't some big-time author who had written books that were changing people's lives or a spiritual leader. He was a bus driver. And yet he had a real power that day. And he used that power in an extraordinary way to change lives. And Elizabeth said she thinks about that all the time. And that if she gets down or is hearing about what's going on in the world or hearing what's going on in her own life, she remembers that bus driver and remembers that each one of us, we do have the power to change things. And if we're doing something we love, it can happen. And I will sometimes think about that, and I did this at the National Storytelling Conference. I told this story for the first time a couple of months ago, and I kind of interweaved it with saying that all of us could learn a short story and tell it. You know, we could be in line at the grocery store, and maybe there's 10 deep, and everybody's tired and ready to get home, and all of a sudden the cash register breaks down, so they got to go get the manager. And in that moment, I was saying to this conference that you could turn to the person behind you and say, would you like to hear a one-minute story? And just tell a story. You could change what is happening in that moment. And what I related to them was in June of this year, earlier in the summer, I was down visiting my brother, Gordon Reagan, who lives in Jacksonville, Florida. And he does something. If he goes into a store and there's not many people there and not many customers or something's not busy, he'll ask the salesperson, would you like to hear a short, clean joke? And I was with him. We went ran errands one afternoon. And he must have asked four or five people. No one said no. Everybody said yes. And so we all have that possibility in us to change things, to bring a different light. We were talking about shining a light. Mm-hmm. We can shine that light on the people that we meet every day and on ourselves and make this world a better place.
That is so true.
So you want to hear the short, clean joke?
Absolutely.
I'll end on this.
I'm waiting for the punchline here.
So this is from my brother, Gordon. And he said there was a young couple they met in high school and fell in love. And it turned out that they had been born on the exact same day, same year and everything.
Wow.
Well, they ended up getting married and having children, and their life went on. And it came to be their 60th birthday. And an angel appeared and offered each one of them a wish. Well, the wife knew right away what she wanted to wish for. She said that she had always wanted to travel. And poof, there were two tickets for a cruise around the world.
Wow.
The angel turned to the man and asked him, and he said, well, you know, actually, I've always wanted a wife that was 30 years younger. And poof, he was 90 years old.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yes.
I have a very good joke that is along that same line, except that the guy would put his hand in his pocket, and every time he would go somewhere, the right change was always in his pocket.
Yes.
And so, there was an ostrich always with this guy. And one day, the waitress, after him being able to pull out the right change every time, asked him, "What is going on?" And he goes, "Well, I was up in my attic, and I came across a brass lantern or a genie lamp, and I rubbed it. The genie came out. They gave me 3 wishes, 2 wishes, whatever." And she goes, "Well, wow. And I wished for money, that I would always have money to buy whatever I want. Hence, whenever he puts his hand in his pocket, he's able to pull out the exact change." And the waitress goes, "Wow, that's great." And she goes, "Well, what's with the ostrich?" And he goes, "Well, I asked for a gal with a big butt and long legs, and this is what I got." So the moral to the story, be careful what you wish for,
right,
folks. There you go. Connie Reagan Blake, it has been an absolute delight to have you here this afternoon. Thanks so much for gracing us here on WCRS.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you so much. And to your listeners.
Absolutely. That's going to do it for us. This is WCRS. Bye-bye, everybody.